Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Hello, everybody. Hope you're doing well. It's a nice sunny afternoon here in Georgia. Hope that you all are doing well. For those of you who are in the path of these storms we had over the past week or so, I hope you're well. I hope your family's well. And I hope your farm is intact. Lord knows we don't need any more problems after what we've had with COVID. And hopefully we'll be done with COVID soon. So I got my first shot last week and go get my second shot in a couple of weeks. Myself and the family went. And so far, we didn't have any problems. Cross our fingers, and hopefully we'll be getting back to normal as soon as we can. I really want to get out there and see all of you in the field. That's usually what I do. I would love to make visits, get back to making visits to our 1890 universities. South Carolina State, from what I understand, just cut the ribbon on a 50-acre on-campus farm. From my understanding, they haven't had a on-campus farm for about 50 years. And so, you know, that's really good news to hear that our 1890s are still hanging in there and being able to prosper and to do what they need to do to assist Black farmers. Just a word of announcement. The Southern Sustainable Agriculture and Research Education Program is now accepting applications for its Research and Education Grant Program. And that program consists of two grants. The Research and Education Grant provides funding to do any type of research around sustainable agriculture. It's a maximum of $400,000 for up to a three-year project. And it opened up to institutions, 1890 land-grant universities. It's open to nonprofits, tribal authorities, local state and local city governments can all apply for this program, and it's a really good program. But they also have a secondary program that's known as the education program, and that provides up to $50,000 to do direct farmer training. So all of you out there who are working with farmers, who are working with training the next cadre of producers and farmers and ranchers who are going to be growing our food heading into the future, this is a grant that you can look at. Not many USDA programs provide for actual direct farmer training, and this provides up to $50,000 to do up to a one-year program. The only comparable program is the USDA's flagship program, the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Grant Program, which provides up to, I believe the number is up to $600,000 for up to a three-year program to do farmer and rancher training anywhere in the United States and the U.S. territories. So I'll put a note to these grants in our show notes, and I would encourage those of you who are eligible to apply. So, you know, when I first moved to the South and we started going to farmers market, and more importantly, when we started selling at farmers markets, the one thing that I noticed was that the one commodity that was in short supply at a lot of markets was fruit. You didn't see much too much in the way of apples or plums or pears. You didn't really see too much of that at farmers market. Yeah, you saw your peaches. You saw maybe some garden grown fruits. Probably saw some muscadines or scuppernong, which are a type of grape. But you really didn't see much at fruit. If I had to start my farm all over again, the one thing that I would do was plant all my fruit first, because A, it can be an extremely valuable income source to your farm, and B, they take such a long time to get developed and to actually bear fruit that you could just put it in the ground, give it the attention it needs, and then go about doing your any type of other production that you're doing on your farm. So I've been thinking about this. You know, when we had our fire back in 2015, we lost all of our fruit trees that we had in the front yard. We put in a front yard orchard and we lost everything. They didn't even have a chance to bear. And we didn't put anything back out there, but we Now that we started getting settled in after the house has been rebuilt and we started taking care and bringing back most of our production areas, Gwen and I said, well, okay, it's time to do our fruit. So we're slowly bringing back our front yard orchard. So we've been planting pears, plums, apples. Trying to think of our blueberries are doing well. We supplemented them back at the end of the last year. We put in some more. We got some brambleberries, some raspberries, and blackberries that we've put in. The one fruit that is doing extremely well on our property is figs. We've got a few fig trees that are just going crazy. Actually, I had offered on Facebook to give some cuttings to people because the trees really needed to be pruned, and I wanted to give some cuttings to folks. I wanted to grow some fig trees. And figs are really easy to propagate. So I had put it out on Facebook that I had some cuttings. I was going to do some pruning and I would have cuttings available. And when I went out to do the cuttings over this weekend, the tree had leafed out. And not only has the trees leafed out, but they have figs on them. So I'm not going to mess with them right now. I just have to let everybody know that they'll have to get their cuttings in the winter next year. So I want to talk about fruits today. A lot of people are mystified by fruits, and some people are intimidated about them. It's really hard to grow certain type of fruits here in the South. For example, one of the first fruits that we planted here when we obtained our property was peach trees. For the life of me, I don't know why Georgia's called the peach state, but peaches are extremely hard to grow in Georgia, actually in the South, in the Southeast, but they are a tree that leaves, that they are a fruit that needs a lot of maintenance. They're very susceptible to pest pressures, and it's just a lot of things that you need to do to them, including spraying, that we just choose not to do. So we're not growing any peaches. Plums and pears and apples we are going to take a chance with. So I want to have on a gentleman by the name of Robbie Ashtroff. Robbie Ashtroff is here in the Atlanta area and does a lot of work with sustainable agriculture, specifically within urban environments, although that's not where he solely works. For example, Robbie has done some work with the Atlanta Urban Food Forest. For those of you who don't know what that is, Atlanta has established a food forest where I think it's 7 acres. I'm not sure of the size of it, but I think it's 7 acres, and it's fruit trees and nut trees and berry bushes. And the idea is that it's a community resource that anybody can go to and get food. You know, the idea of the commons. It's a common area that people can go and get food. Well, Robbie did some work in getting to have that food forest established. And I'm really proud of it because in Atlanta, you know, Atlanta has a really happening urban ag scene, and that's just one facet of it, but it's an important facet. So I want to have Robbie on. Robbie also works with a gentleman by the name of James Carr here in the city of Atlanta. And James does a lot of media work. You know, podcasts, video photography, and that type of stuff. Well, they've started a group called, an organization called Farmers Jam. And what it started out as, they noticed that many of the farmers, you know, even farmers that I know and farmers that they regularly engage with, played some type of instrument. So basically what Farmers Jam is, they get together and just have these impromptu jam sessions. And they get together and they play. And the idea is eventually they, you know, they use these as fundraisers. And with the money that they raise, they donate fruit trees to farmers, to folks who are farming in and around the Atlanta area. Well, it's not necessarily even in Atlanta, within the state of Georgia. And so, for example, they just donated three trees to us. We got a pear, a plum, and a apple tree. So that helps supplement our front yard orchard that we got going. I'll put some links in the show notes as to how you can get in touch with them to see the work that they're doing. So, you know, it's really important that we, if you're a small farmer or you're small to mid-scale farmers, because let's face it, the odds are stacked against us in as many ways that you can think of. And one of the things that we have to do is remain viable, financially viable. And that means not just growing a single crop as many farmers are doing. You know, one of the big topics of discussion right now is that $5 billion component of the Reaching American Cares Act that earmarked to assisting Black farmers who have been hurt, injured by the years of discrimination, particularly by the USDA. And while that program is specifically targeted toward farmers who have loan that for, you know, that they either felt, they either went into foreclosure on or they had other problems with, mainly due to the intransigence of the USDA, that they can get some relief. And, you know, and that's a first step, because if you don't know the history of the USDA and Black farmers, you really owe it to yourself to sit down and just look at what has transpired between the USDA and Black farmers throughout the years. And there's plenty of information out there. And I'm probably going to have some people come on and talk about, you know, some of the issues that went on. But anyway, there's this $5 billion component. Most of that money is going to, like I said, help mitigate some of these problems with these longstanding problems with some of these loans. And then they're putting, I think 80% of the money is going toward that. 20% of the money is going to some other things. Actually, when I sat in on a hearing, and what was described as far as this $5 billion component seemed to me like a scaled down version of the Justice for Black Farmers Act that was drafted by Senators Klobuchar and Senators Booker. And so that's what it seemed like to me. So I don't know if this is going to be a test run and how they can get through this through Congress. But it's one of the things that that bill and some of the narrative around this type of legislation is that it's very, very important for small farmers. I don't care what color you are, to be honest with you. It's very important for farmers to make sure that they have a viable farm, that your farm is bringing in the income that you need to sustain the farm, to sustain your family, to help you put your kids to school, because that's what farms did, you know, even for Black farmers. You know, I meet a lot of guys in NRCS and who now work for the federal government. You know, their daddies and their mamas and their great granddaddies, they all ran farms, and that's how they use that money to help put their kids to school. And that's been changing, and we don't have that bedrock anymore. So hopefully this is coming back. But I want to talk about fruit, because fruit's a very underutilized potential income stream for farmers. So I want to bring Robbie on to talk about, you know, just take some of the mystery out of planting fruits, and to just maybe plant a seed for those of you who haven't done any fruit, or if you're just starting your farm, or if you have a farm and you've got some existing fruit trees on it, but they're not putting out any fruit. I hope you take away some tips and expertise from Robbie. So as we get forward, this is episode number 13 of the Ag Rider. Like I said, I expected to have this podcast be a lot more mature and a further more developed, you know, to the extent that we would be having in-person meetings, some gatherings and demonstrations across the Southeast. But until we get this COVID thing under control, this is the way I have to come to you. So I would ask you to take a minute, if you're getting valuable information, to make sure you give me a rating on any of the streaming podcasts that you go to. I would also like to ask you to send me any show ideas you have. I have, for those of you who know me and for those of you who don't know me, I have a pretty extensive network of folks that I can connect with throughout the South, pretty much about any subject. So if there's something that you want to hear discussed on the show, please send me an email at info@sustainableagrider.com. So that's info@sustainableagrider.com. We'll make that show happen. So without further ado, here's my interview with Robbie Ashtroff on planting fruit trees in the South. Ooh, 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 ooh. Welcome back to the Sustainable Ag Writer. My guest today is Robbie Ashgrove, and we're going to be talking fruit trees today. How are you doing today, Robbie?
Doing great, Brennan. Thanks for having me on.
Good. You were busy out on the farm today?
Today was a day off for me, but I was on the home front doing some pruning and pulling some weeds.
Okay, so this is a timely conversation then.
It sure is.
Yeah, so I want to have you on because a lot of people now are starting to plan their little homesteads and making additions or starting their little market gardens. And I want to have a conversation about fruit. So before we get started, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Robbie Ashgrove. I live here in East Atlanta for 12 years. I'm an ecologist and environmental educator. Started my career doing a lot of field ecology and plant work, doing, you know, more like, you know, science and plant work. And then eventually came to the realization that all this great information that we were learning wasn't getting down to the public. And I became an environmental educator. And at some point in my career, I found agriculture. And I noticed in Atlanta that there was an incredible strong movement of gardens and farms, but no one was really working with trees in a significant way. And I took it upon myself to, you know, really push perennial fruit trees, berry bushes, you know, really sustainable agriculture. And it's been a great ride planting all over the city for the last 10 years now.
Yeah, it has. And I know you were a major component, if not the driver behind the Atlanta Food Forest. So you can tell, before we get started talking about actually about fruit trees, can you tell people a little bit about what that project was and where it's at today?
Sure. And I definitely want to acknowledge I was definitely not the main driver. This was a beautiful case of community collaboration with federal funding, the city of Atlanta, nonprofits, individuals, farmers and growers. And I played a small part of it, you know, doing fruit tree planting and education. And it's been about 2 years now, and, you know, it's really blossomed. There's a community garden, there's a fruit orchard, there's a medicinal plant area, 7 acres, 7.1 acres, actually. It's the largest in the country, and they've had goats out there doing invasive plant removal. There's plans for a greenhouse, an event area. There's been consistent programming and engagement, and, you know, most importantly, it's feeding families in the neighborhood. And so I continue to stay plugged in, and there's a lot of great press about it. So I invite people to learn more about it.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll pull some links. You know, as I travel around the Southeast in my work, you know, a lot of people sleep on Atlanta's urban ag environment. You know, I'd match it up pretty much to anyone's in the country. The, you know, some of the stuff that I've seen going on in urban agriculture within Atlanta, from the adoption of the urban ag ordinance to the work with the food forest, Atlanta has really been doing some amazing things.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And yeah, I've been telling my friends out west what we're doing in Florida. And, you know, we got the great growing season, but we got so many passionate people here, and there's space in the city, which is amazing. Yeah. Big things happening.
So let's talk about fruit trees. So I always tell people, if I had to start my operation, if I had to start Phoenix Gardens all over again, the first thing I would do is plant fruit trees. We didn't really plant any until late. And our first ones got wiped out. Our first planting, our first small orchard got wiped out when we had our fire back in 15. So we're starting again. Just tell me, when you're in the South, first of all, just give some basics about fruit trees, what you should be looking for, what type of fruit grows really well here in the South. Now, my listeners stem anywhere from the Virginia area, the mountains of North Carolina, all the way down to Florida and Texas. So I realize that's a really broad swath of country. But just in general, when you're, no matter where you are, and you want to establish some type of orchard, what's the first things you should be looking at?
Great question. There's a lot there. You want to be looking at your commitment, I think, is first to acknowledge. These fruit trees could live 4 to 5 to 6 decades. And so you want to make sure you have the time and the space, and then the things that the tree really needs to be productive, which would be like sunshine and good pruning, mulch, and nutrients and, you know, care. We're really lucky in the South. We got, you know, a long growing season, mild winter, decent soil. You know, I'm going to speak a lot from Atlanta. We're in zone, okay. Are we 7A?
I think we're 7B now.
7B. So yeah, we're really blessed to have a lot of biological diversity and just options from anything that would start early in the season to fruit, like in May, like Nanking cherries, to, you know, late season things like persimmons and walnuts. I'm going to talk a little bit about nuts, but definitely keep it more in the fruit realm.
Okay.
So that's one thing. And, you know, and with really good planning, you could have things harvesting every month, from small fruits to vines to shrubs and trees.
Yeah. And there's a plethora of fruits you can grow. And I didn't realize we can grow cherries down here. Are the Nankings already a specific type of cherry?
Yes, it's a bush cherry. I would say it's definitely used in the ornamental trade. It just happens to have a delicious little berry. But just to give listeners a sense, you know, let me just kind of read off the menu, so to speak, you know, what we can grow in the South. But, you know, everything from apples to pears, peaches and nectarines. There's plums and apricots and some cherries. There's loads of different types of berries, you know, blueberry being the shining star, at least in Georgia. Lots of grapes, you know, I favor the muscadine. There are some citrus options as you move further into the coastal plain. Figs, I think, are a really great tree for the South. Persimmons as well, which is a great fall bearing crop. And then, you know, there's a bunch of like specialty fruits, which are kind of cool and interesting, like the feijoa or the pineapple guava, loquats. There's passion fruit, not necessarily a tree, but a great vine. Pomegranates, and even some bananas, you know, further south. So that's a pretty good spread. And then I didn't even mention, you know, pawpaws and mayhaws, elderberry, and a service berry, all the native stuff, which I think, you know, deserves pole position.
Right. It's funny you should mention citrus. We had a TV production company out here. You know Jamila Norman, right? I'm sure you
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so apparently she's working with this production company to produce this series for, I believe it's Discovery Channel, working with home gardeners or farm. And it came out here to, because we do have citrus trees here. And we brought in Lindy Savelle, who runs a large citrus operation and has been working closely with the University of Georgia with their citrus trees. And I think as climate change, we're going to be being able to grow more and more tropical stuff. I just went outside and I saw a banana tree that we had left it out and just forgot about it. And I would thought the thing was dead.
Got it from the top.
Yep, it's coming from the top. I was so glad to see that green when I went outside today. So let's start with the easy stuff. One of the first fruit trees I planted were peaches. And I just had a time with them. When I did get fruit, they were all buggy. You know, we try and stay as organic as we can here. You know, Georgia's called the peach state. But more and more, as I try to grow them, I wonder why. So what's the deal with peaches?
Yeah, we're the peach state, and I think I've planted less than 5 in 10 years.
Wow.
Only when people really, really wanted it. And I love peaches. However, and I'm speaking again from the Piedmont, mm-hmm. it's a tough sell here. Also, to your point about doing organically, very, very difficult. I would consider a peach a high maintenance variety to just deal with some of the pests and maintenance. Now, I've also seen peaches do amazing as well. So, you know, my spirit is always like, give it a shot and go for it. But this would not be my first choice for anyone starting out.
Okay. Okay. And we're going to run through just a list of different varieties and, you know, different fruits. And if you have any recommended varieties for the area, we can talk about them. So let's say I've got a spot for my orchard picked out, Robbie. What should I do in terms of preparing the site to get ready to receive fruit tree?
Good question. You know, I don't really do a whole lot of, you know, tilling or anything like that. I think preparing the site really makes, I would translate that to make sure you're picking the right spot.
Gotcha.
And so you want to make sure that you have, you know, ample sunlight, usually about 5 hours plus would be, you know, good for production. You want to evaluate, you know, just the condition of the soil. Is it compacted? What was the previous land use? What is the current land use? You know, I always do the look up, look down, look all around test and really evaluate what you got there. Planting on a slope could be a good thing for airflow, for example, and also just, you know, for drainage. You don't necessarily want to plant in a bog, but, you know, we have a little saying in the tree business is the right tree for the right place. So what I've found is in areas that don't meet some of those qualifications, for example, that are in the shade maybe a little wet. It's not going to be where you're going to put your persimmons and service berries, but you can certainly do something like elderberry or mayhaw, something that likes their feet wet. So it's kind of like a matchmaking exercise, like dating. You know, you got the tree that has certain likes and requirements, and you got a site that pretty much won't change, you know?
Right.
So you gotta make the link and make the match.
Okay.
But as far as when you get to planting, I can talk about is, I cannot stress this enough, never want to shortchange the tree. If you give it the TLC up front, it will pay you back and get that return on investment. So when it comes to digging the hole, mm-hmm. you want to dig $1 million hole for a dollar tree. And roots grow out, not down. So typically mm-hmm. the hole, doing it correctly, is very wide, kind of resembles like a shallow bowl. Never okay. want to make the walls, you know, like vertical. And one of the things that I take a lot of pride in that even professional landscape companies don't do is I score the sides of the hole. So one of the last steps is you just take your shovel, your pickaxe, just really ram it in, open up, make spaces. And if you're planting bare root, take mm-hmm. the time to hand place the root in these crevices and cracks and really give the tree a jump life. So that's one of the advantages to getting bare root trees. You know, when you're at shopping for trees, you can get something in a container, which is great. You got to really take the time to loosen the roots. We call that the root massage. Or you buy bare root, which is what I'm talking about.
Okay. And so the bare roots, like you said, you should have basically a shallow hole. So it's better to go wide than go deep. So, you know, I see a lot of people going with getting augers to plant their fruit trees. But listening to what you're saying, that may not necessarily be the type of hole that we want for the tree. Is that accurate?
It is. You know, if you have 100 trees to bang out, then maybe the auger would be the good start it out. But mm-hmm. I would say it all needs to be finished by hand and okay. have the hole be a little bit irregular, if that makes sense. You know, roots are opportunistic. Mm-hmm. And so when they find the water and they find the air and the space, they're going to go for it. I've seen it happen.
Okay. So any special things for container board trees? You know, so with the bare root, we're going to open up the sides of those holes and get those roots trained to grow through them. But when you have the container grown trees, for example, you're getting, say, a 2-year-old tree in a couple of gallon container. What should the person do to make sure that tree gets off to a good start?
Yeah. So I mentioned it earlier. I'm going to go into more detail, but mm-hmm. once you pop that tree out of the container, you'll know if that tree's been in the container for too long. Start to see circular roots and just like a really firm mat of roots. Mm-hmm. And what you want to do is roughen it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. I kind of equate it to like, you know, sisters taking out their braids. You know, you don't want to break it out, but you definitely want to loosen it up.
Gotcha.
So take the time to really loosen the root ball. Sometimes you might even take a shovel at it. Never do it horizontally. Always do it vertically. That way the root ball stays intact. And then you want to make sure you see where the root flare is. That's basically where the base of the trunk meets the ground, and make sure you get the level, your elevation planted. We always say planter high, never die. So I always go about like, you know, an inch above the root ball should be sticking up above the plane of the ground.
Oh, really? Okay.
If that makes sense. Yeah. Never want to plant the tree in a hole.
Gotcha. Okay. I think I planted so many trees wrong then. So hopefully they'll make it. I've got a few more to plant. So this is a timely conversation. As far as backfilling the hole, was there any special way you're supposed to sit it in there? You know, I know you sit it above an inch above the height of the hole, but is there anything else as far as placing the plant in that hole that our listeners should know about?
No, I think that's really the major concern is getting the elevation right.
Now, as far as backfilling that hole, what should we be putting in that hole? The dirt that we dug out of there, or can we go ahead and put some compost or any other type of amendment?
This is a great question, and I get this, and I think it deserves a little explanation and time.
Okay.
So especially here in the Piedmont, you know, we got the red clay, supposedly not very nutritious, but I differ when I look around Atlanta's dense tree canopy cover. But the consensus for most people is to fill that hole with, you know, black gold and compost and all this business, which makes sense. My concern is that when you put the tree in this amazing environment, that when the roots grow and it literally hits that brick wall, which is the clay, it could stunt the tree. And mm-hmm. really what's best for the tree to kind of get acclimatized to where it's at is you use the exact same soil that you pulled out, the parent soil, and backfill with that. What I will do is I'll top dress with compost, and or like my favorite is getting like wood chips that have been sitting for like 4 or 5 years and using that. And basically you're delivering the nutrients like nature does every, you know, fall time. You got leaves that fall to the ground and those decompose, and then they'll kind of percolate slowly over time down. So you're doing the same thing. You're just going to deliver the nutrients on the surface and then let it perk down.
So that's good. So we've got our tree planted. We've got whatever soil that we're going to put into the hole. What else should be done with young tree? So you've got it planted. Does anything else need to be done, or she's all ready to go?
So once you plant it, you definitely want to cover the base of the tree, the root ball, with some mulch. One important note is you never want to have the mulch kind of touching the tree. I always ask people if they think it would be comfortable to wear a wet sock around their neck all day. And that answer is no, of course. And right. The tree doesn't like it either. And so you never want to have that moist water retaining material up against the trunk that'll lead to rot. So you do need to pull it back. And I always put, 6 to 8 inches on. That mulch is going to provide additional moisture. It'll be weed suppression. And then again, if I'm using that 4 or 5 year aged mulch, I usually, when I put my mulch down, there's probably at least 20 worms in it. So okay. They're going to help aerate and provide castings and nutrients. So you got the tree planted, you've got it mulched, going to water. And then especially for a young fruit tree, you're going to give it its first pruning right there on the spot. And so
that's probably a good segue to talk about pruning.
Sure. So let's say you just got that young tree. Sometimes they call it a whip in the industry. It's literally like one branch, one trunk. Depending on the species and depending how high you want your branches to form, you're going to cut it. They say 18 to 26 inches off the ground, just one single cut. And so when we talk about pruning, it's necessary. And sometimes people are surprised at how aggressive it needs to be. And pruning is done for a few reasons. Number one, it's going to help your trees be more productive. You're going to have symmetrically even and well-supported scaffold branches to support a real heavy fruit load. An unchecked tree, while it's getting bigger and taller and looks good, you're getting like these spindly branches that will just break once a lot of weight comes. And so, if you're doing it right, expect to be rewarded with, heavy, heavy loads. So you have to train your tree, be able to support that weight. The other thing that pruning will do is you're going to make sure that all your branches are getting sunlight, especially in the interior of certain stone fruits like pecans and plums. It's going to help you manage disease and also make sure that airflow can happen in the interior of the tree. So just to continue on, there's two different types of cuts in pruning. There's thinning cuts, which is, completely removing and taking away. And then there's tipping cuts, and tipping, promotes growth. And so just to get a little existential with you for a second, I think pruning is like time travel. And so what you're doing today is based on what happened yesterday, all for tomorrow. Okay. Get that? Mm-hmm. So when I return to a tree that I've been pruning for the past 3 years, I'm evaluating and asking myself, did it do what I wanted it to do? Did the branches get easier to pick and lower off the ground? Am I spreading the tree out wider and allowing more sunlight? And then I'm going to make a decision today that's going to continue that vision. Or if something didn't work, I'm going to try something else. And so it's really important to know what species you have before you start pruning and to learn what the preferred habit is. And habit describes the shape of the tree. So there's, single leader, which is kind of like pears, most apples. And then there is multi-trunk or open center, which is the preferred habit for plums and, stone fruits.
Okay, almost like a big bowl, I think I've heard it described.
Exactly.
All right. So that's pruning for when you first put it in the ground. And before we go any further, pruning is one of those things that you really have to have a visual for it. Are there any sources or any places on the web that you could point people to that will really give them a good indication of this is what you should be doing?
Yeah, I can't call out any favorites right now, okay. But, there's different pruning videos and most extension services have tutorials. There's books on it. I think it'd be great to go to a place that's already had work done and see it and go back you know, year after year, or even witness like some of these big commercial operations do their pruning. Now, they might have very specific goals for production. And personally, I kind of like a tree to be a tree. So I don't mind it getting, you know, 15, 20 feet tall, but most people want to keep it like super low for harvesting. Like if some birds get, you know, I'm down with that. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I think it's important for people just to like know what their goals are, and then to seek out the information that would be most helpful.
Okay. So that was a newly established trees. You gave us a short promo on how to prune. What about older trees? So I've got a tree here. It's a pear tree that I just didn't keep up with it. It's still healthy, but it's not really giving me any production. What is that tree beyond repair, or can I go in and do the necessary pruning to make sure that it'll eventually bear fruit?
Yeah, I hear that a lot. That's a very common MO is, you know, I got this older tree, hasn't been touched. It's looking good and healthy, but not really doing so much on the fruit production. So one thing to understand about larger trees, especially that haven't seen work in a while, is you need to plan out the work over at least a few seasons. Okay. And as a rule of thumb, it's you always want to never cut more than 30%, one third about, you know, of the tree. You got to remember that the tree needs its leaves to feed itself. Mm-hmm. And so if you take off a certain amount of volume off of a big tree, it's not going to fare well. Additionally, trees, you know, the whole cause and effect relationship is very present in trees. If a tree starts to lean one way, you know, send up like suckers to correct it. If you top a tree in a major way, it's going to come back really hard. And you don't really want that per se. Mm-hmm. So definitely space it out over the course of some time. And typically, I'll give you a good example, is pear trees. Pear trees do great in the South. They're very vigorous. They grow very upright and columnar. And so a tree, a big pear tree unchecked is this like, it looks like a dog hair stand of a forest in the middle of a tree, if you can see, if that visual makes sense to you, mm-hmm. Brandon.
Yeah.
And so it just gets like really thick. There's like a million liters, super dense, which is not mm-hmm. really good. And so what you need to do over time is start to select leaders that you will keep and thin out the areas that you're going to open up. And, you know, it can be corrected over time.
Okay. So we talked about pruning. Can we talk about, before we talk about selecting, what fruit really does well? And this is something I learned when I really started to look at fruit. There's a concept called chill hour. Can you explain to our audience what that is and why that's important when you're looking at trees?
Yeah. So chill hours, I don't know the exact definition, but it's the amount of time that is the, you know, outside is spent under 45 degrees, I believe. And most or all fruit trees need a certain amount, a minimum of chill hours to produce fruit. Being in the South, certain species will have higher chill hour requirements. Think of apples. Apples do really great in the Northeast, Vermont, New Hampshire, New York. That part of the country has a lot more time under 45 degrees than we do. And so those apple trees are typically high chill hour apples. If you get apple trees from up there and plant them down here, it's kind of like a mismatch. And so some of our universities and extension services have done plant breeding and research, you know, here at UGA, Auburn, you know, many of the land grant schools, they create varieties that are better for our area. So when it comes to apples, you want to get a low chill hour apple for the South. The one I have is an Anna. There's also a Golden Dorset. They're somewhere in the 300 chill hour range. And my apple tree has been blooming for the last week, which, you know, seems early, but that's the point, is that these apples will be ready in June, as opposed to other varieties that are, you know, with higher chill hours that you would have to find, you know, in LJ up there.
All right. So that explains that. And hopping right back over to pruning for a minute. When should you be pruning your trees?
Yeah, that's a really great point. I missed that. So pruning season is best performed when the trees are dormant. I like February, March time. A lot of times prune just before the bud burst. That way I can really evaluate and see which branches are dead or alive. You can always give it, you know, the scratch test, but it's really nice to see, you know, which ones are clearly dead. It's a little difficult to do when the tree's dormant, if you could imagine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sometimes, and I've read that, you know, a summer pruning can be done. It's a different method of pruning. my only concern is just, you know, making a wound during that time of year,
right?
Necessarily best for the tree, but some thinning cuts, for example, can be performed at any time, but it's always best to do it when the tree's dormant before it leaves out.
Okay. So we've talked about, you know, just the general fruits that can grow here. And it's funny now that you mentioned, so I picked up from Atlanta Harvest. We went and brought some fruit trees from last year. They were a little bit older trees and they're starting to blossom now. If those trees, they're very young now, they're still very young trees, and I did prune them, but they're still getting some blossoms on them. If for some reason they were supposed, they would start to form fruit, should I let those fruit stay on there or should I get rid of them?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've learned just growing here in Atlanta is this idea of fruit thinning. And let's talk about plums. I'd say it's definitely necessary to thin out plums, peaches. It's just the idea of having fewer high quality fruit versus a bunch of little whatevers. The other thing that it helps to do is it will relieve and lessen the weight on the branch. So sometimes these fruit sets are just so thick and loaded, which is awesome and exciting. And, you know, most people are like, great, I'm going to leave it right there. And what you want to do is, you know, you can do something like every other one. Because what you need to kind of envision is as that fruit grows and matures, you want to have space for it to grow. When two fruits actually touch each other, that touching, and then like say there's rain, that could lead to like rot, disease, and just blemishes. And gotcha. So fruits grow independently. It will be fewer fruit, but you'll have bigger and juicier and better.
Okay. Okay. And as far as young trees producing, is there a time when a young tree starts to produce fruit that you should not let that fruit mature? Or let's say you've got a 4-year tree and it's starting to put out fruit. Should you let that fruit grow to maturity or should you take it off? Because I've heard it go two ways. One guy who owns an orchard up in the mountains was telling me that he would take it all off if it's a younger tree. He would remove all the fruit. And then I've heard other people say the other thing, that they would just leave it on. So how do you handle that?
So I think a good example is maybe talk, you know, with blueberries. Mm-hmm. And so a very young and small blueberry, let's say you plant it, like a 1 gallon or even a 3 gallon, right? So pretty small. In general, blueberries and fruit trees, on average, give or take, we're talking like maybe 4 to 5 years before you see fruit. That's just for it to get sizable, you know, good flower set and then fruit. So the thought is it takes a lot of energy to produce, you know, fruit and flowers. So for the first 2-3 years for blueberries, when they start to produce fruit, you can just like knock them off with your finger. And that way, all the energy goes into vegetative growth and the tree actually will get bigger. And I think that's wise. I don't expect any like 2 to 3 year tree to really produce much. I mean, I've seen big put stuff on, and maybe for a family with kids, like, yeah, let it happen and get excited with like one little fig.
Right.
But I think there is some merit to doing the thinning to get more vegetative growth.
Okay. Now, I've got some fig trees that have gotten monstrous, Robbie, and they're not that old, but I mean, they're just going everywhere. And they do produce a lot of fruit. It's getting so Gwen wants me to trim them to the top because she can't reach them. They get done up there. Should you have a pruning regimen with figs?
It depends. Yeah, what your goal is. Mm-hmm. If you want to have a big ass tree, then don't do anything.
Right.
If no one wants to get on a ladder and you want to have more control over harvesting, then definitely some height control would be necessary.
Okay, so we've talked about some of the basics. One other thing I want to talk to you about is just diseases. What diseases, especially down here in this hot and humid South, what diseases are we typically going to run into, say with the typical fruits like apples, plums, pears, that those types of fruits? Are there any diseases we need to be on watch out for, and are any preventive steps we can take to reduce the chance that our trees get diseased?
So yes, certain species and families are definitely susceptible to different diseases. Part of doing your homework is finding disease-resistant varieties to plant. And again, I point to the university breeding programs and, you know, nurserymen and things like that. One of the common things that we see in, you know, pears, apples, and quince as well is fire blight. And the sign of fire blight is the tree's doing really great, And then all of a sudden, it just kind of loses gas and the branch kind of starts to droop. You'll actually start to see like a little bit of blackening on the branch. You'll have complete dieback. Sometimes the flower, you know, comes out and the fruit starts to form and it just kind of doesn't do anything and decays, you know, and you can prune it out, meaning you need to go 6 to 8 inches below that and cut it out and, you know, and dispose of it. Don't just let it fall on the ground. Something else that I've been seeing more of, and I need to learn more about, affects plum trees. It's called black knot. Oh. And it's, I think it's fungal, and it basically just forms. It kind of looks like a gall. It's this big black thing. And, you know, sometimes it appears and it doesn't really hurt the tree, but it will grow. And, you know, you also have to prune those out. The problem I've run into is once a tree gets infested, I mean, like, you basically have to prune out so much that you're not even left with a tree.
Gotcha.
And, okay. And there was a plum I must have planted in 2012. And man, it did its thing. It was awesome. But this black knot kind of went unchecked. And I went to go visit the trees actually last week because it was like plum week when all the plums mm-hmm. are flowering. Mm-hmm. And they were cut down. I mean, it kind of had to be done, but mm-hmm. It was a bummer.
Who manages the trees out there?
What's that?
And who manages the trees in the, like say in a food forest? Do they just go for what they know? Do you have volunteers come in and do stuff like carve out that black knot?
Yeah. So I was actually just referencing a spot in a park. But at the food forest specifically, there's a couple different things happening. They have, you know, really great partners such as Trees Atlanta. Shout out to Mike McCord, who's been out there with the Food Forest Ranger. Also Concrete Jungle, which is Atlanta's fruit foraging organization, who I've done work on behalf and did when the food forest first kicked off. We did a few plantings and pruning classes there. And then they have a fantastic friends group, which is like the neighbors and locals, and have lots of volunteers. So it's a great example of community engagement with a whole bunch of different partners and people plugging in.
Okay, good. So you mentioned that one of the other things I want to talk about is pollination. So that's the other thing that was really interesting to me when I started looking at fruit, is that depending on what you could either have self-pollinating varieties or you need to bring in a pollinator. And many times that needs to be, if I'm not mistaken, a different variety. And there's certain varieties that make good pollinators. So could you talk about that a little bit, say, from the standpoint of, say, apples or pears?
Yes. So many of the fruits need pollination to occur. And while there are self-pollinating or self-fruitful varieties, I personally like getting a mix-up. And, you know, a good species to talk about is blueberries. So a lot of them are cultivars. It's cultivated varieties. Most in the South have or named after Native American tribes. And so you don't want to get six or seven of the same one. You want to get different varieties so they can pollinate. The other thing that tends to happen is when you get multiple varieties within the species is that they all fruit and flower slightly in a different time, but still overlap, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah.
And what that does is it basically spreads your harvest over the course of several weeks. So again, six of the same variety are all going to blossom and fruit at the same time. But if you get two, two, and two, it spreads it out. And many varieties definitely require a partner, like pawpaws, apples, pears, plums, sometimes cherries are self-pollinating. There's a great variety I like called Stella or Compact Stella. And then some of the natives, fig does not require a partner per se, but it's really important that you do the research and look it up. For example, for apples, UGA has a really great resource. It's called like the Home Apple Orchard series, and they do it for many of the fruits. And they've divided certain species varieties into groups. So there's group A, group B, and group C. And so you want to make sure that you're getting trees in the same or, you know, close group. Like, for example, you wouldn't want to get A and C, but maybe A and B would work, or B and C works really well. So definitely a detail to pay attention to.
All right. And is that a publication, that Home Apple Orchard series, or is this just a line of trees?
It is a publication by UGA.
Okay. I'll look that up and put it in the show notes. Do you need a certain ratio of pollinated trees to other trees? So let's say I'm putting in 10 apple trees, do I need to pay attention to the ratio of, and the trees that need to be pollinated, do I need to pay attention to a ratio? So for example, can I put in one pollinator and nine of the other trees, or is there a certain ratio I need to pay attention to?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know if there's a certain prescription, but again, I would err on diversity within the species, just to have, you know, different varieties and harvest at different times.
All right. So I want to go through a couple of types of fruits and see what your recommended varieties are. So we said apple, and it's funny, I just planted some Anna, and I think Golden Dorset, I think you said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other varieties you would recommend for the South? I know we're here in the Piedmont, but that just shown themselves to be overall good provider producers in the South.
Well, so apple varieties for the lower South, again, these would probably be the ones that require the lowest chill outburst. So like the Anna is, you know, 100 to 300. There's one called the Cox Orange, which is about 600 to 700. That, again, is only 100 to 200. But as you move further north into like the mid to upper South, things like Arkansas Black would be great.
I heard of that.
Braeburn, both of these are now at 800 to 900, 1,000 chill hours. Okay. The Gala is at, you know, 800.
Okay. And everybody knows Gala apples have become pretty popular. What about pears?
So for pears, I think one of the more popular ones has been the kefir pear. That's probably most available. I know the nursery that I shop at has another variety called Moon Glow, which I believe is self-fertile. And there's also pineapple pear.
And to round out the big three, what about plums?
So plums, there's a lot of them. And again, I usually look to some of the university releases. And typically, it's evident in the naming of them. So for example, there's an AU Roadside or an AU Rosa. That's from Auburn. There's also a Beauty and a Bruce plum. And these are pretty low chill hour plums. That's again why they're blooming right now. One that I've had good luck with for a while is Methley. It does have a good amount of disease tolerance, as well as the Santa Rosa variety.
Now let's talk about some of these in a little bit of time we have left, some of these unusual trees that we can grow here in the South. So loquats, which I just planted two, I think they're going on their second year now. Can you tell people what they are? I mean, what type of fruit they are and how well they do?
Yeah, I think one of the redeeming things and qualities of the loquat is that it's evergreen. Pretty much all the fruit trees that we've been talking about are deciduous, and trees can form function as well. So if you're looking to do a screen or just bring some dark mass to your landscape, loquats would be great. They probably are a little sensitive to the cold, so I think this is better for the coastal plain folks. It does flower in the fall or winter, which is kind of pretty. And then the fruit comes in like middle or early summer.
Oh, so it flowers in the fall and then the fruit forms in the summer. That's interesting.
It is.
All right. Yeah, we'll have two. Ours have been doing well so far. We've had them for a couple of years. They haven't borne fruit yet. Actually, we had them in there because I didn't know if we could keep them outside or not. Someone from Atlanta said, yeah, they'll do fine. Just watch them when it gets really, really cold. But we had those cold temperatures the other week, and they just came through it fine. I didn't have any leaf loss or anything. Persimmon.
Yeah, so persimmons are really great. They're beautiful. They have high ornamental value just because the fruit, that you see in the fall time, this beautiful kind of orange globus fruit is dangling from the trees. Usually the leaves would have fallen off, and then you're just left with this like skeleton. It looks like ornaments sometimes. And so what I'm talking about is the Asian persimmon. And so there's, you know, a whole bunch of different varieties. Most of these are non-astringent, although there are some astringent varieties.
But and what's that mean? What's astringent mean?
So anyone who's ever tasted an astringent persimmon knows exactly what I mean. But I think it's like chewing on chalk.
Okay.
It's a face that if your friends see you make this face, they'll never forget it. And it's a very unpleasant taste. And so it's a reminder for some of these non-astringent varieties. You always want to eat the fruit off the ground and not off the tree. And I will say that this point in my life, I'm eating more stuff off the ground than I ever have in my whole life. I just see stuff on the ground, I pick it up and eat it in the forest. And my friends are like, what are you doing? But the other persimmon, and this is maybe a good transition to kind of end to talk about some other really great species, is the native persimmon. Okay. And the native persimmon is found just growing, you know, wild in our forest. You can, it's dioecious, meaning that it could be a male or a female. So you want to work hard to make sure you can get a female from your nursery. Mm-hmm. But these are the smaller kind of golf ball size persimmons laden with seeds. Anyone who does, fall hiking will see a lot of deer scat loaded with persimmon seeds. And I think it's like candy. It's very sweet, delicious fruit. You know, in my family, we've passed on making pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving, and now we make persimmon pie.
Oh,
it's harvest right around Thanksgiving. So I really like that. And just to stay with the natives for a second, Brennan, I really want to big up the service berry. That's Amelanchier. And that's a small flowering tree that's found all over the country, but does really well in the Southeast. And it's a three-season tree. It has a beautiful flower that's just starting to open now. Opens about the same time as the dogwoods. An incredible fruit. It's almost like a blueberry on a tree. Similar color, very high in antioxidants. Delicious. Birds love it. And then has very dynamic and beautiful fall color. And it's about 25, 30 feet tall, sometimes a little shorter. It's shade tolerant, as most of the natives are. But in addition to serviceberry, you know, I should talk about pawpaw a little bit, North America's largest native fruit. It grows exclusively in the temperate area, but it has a very tropical taste, maybe the most tropical tasting fruit that we have here above the Piedmont, above the coastal plain. It's kind of like a banana mango.
That's what I heard. It tastes like banana.
Have you had one before, Brennan?
No, I haven't.
I will bring you one this year. Remind me.
Okay. Okay.
And then I also want to big up, elderberry and mayhaw, which make delicious berry. Elderberry wine is fantastic. These are also very high in antioxidants. They are virtually pest-free. They're medicinal. They're a part of our native ecology. They have relationships with other animals. And I can't stress enough to plant some of the natives as well. I also think from, a market perspective that, these specialty fruits can bring in, a good payload at market as well.
Yeah. Yes. And also get consumers, because, one thing about the local food movement is we're all about education. So, things like pawpaws and service berries, the more we can talk about them being native plants, the more we can get people interested in, A, trying them, but also letting them know what we need to preserve their habitat, that type of stuff, to make sure that these things survive. I have not seen a pawpaw. I was down. I have this area where I have folks dump wood chips. And one day I looked down and it was this vine, and then it had a fruit on it. And coming to find out, it was passion fruit. I don't know how it got there or if it's just once again, a native here in Georgia. What I've been trying to do is get it out of that area and propagate it to where, I can take care of it. But is passion fruit a native to Georgia?
Absolutely. It's beautiful flower. It's a host plant for, I think it's Ibra swallowtail butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super vigorous. I have it growing along the back of my fence. I love the flower. It's definitely native.
What's the best way to move and propagate that? Because the area then, it seems to love that area, but I really want to get, because it doesn't get taken care of. And can you dig it up and just repot it? Or
yeah, it digs super easy, but I would caution you and everyone listening to beware, because this joker will run on you. But if you pick the right spot, then let it do its thing, right?
Okay. All right. And it sounds like it'd be maybe a good candidate for containers, large containers with a trellis or something. So
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I love the container idea to contain it. But however, make sure you give it room to climb.
Okay. Okay, Robbie. The other thing is, where should people look to get their trees? Because I see people running to Home Depot to get fruit trees. I brought a couple of pears, and maybe that's another reason I had problems with trees, because I went to a big box store and picked them up. But how does someone go about finding a good nursery that knows what they're doing in terms of fruit?
Yeah, the deals are really tempting at the big box, but I'd say, folks, let's keep our dollars in our state and support other growers. And you're destined to get a variety. Like, this is how it works. Some Home Depot in Michigan has all these leftover apple trees, and so they send them down south for us to buy.
Okay.
And it doesn't work as well. Right. So there's, you know, Georgia has a nursery association, which, you know, has directories. There's also a few books, I believe. I'm trying to find it as I speak, but it's called The Georgia Food Forest. The last name of the author, I believe, is Dill, D-I-L-L. And there's an excellent nursery section in the back. Okay. And just to talk to your growers.
Okay.
And I guess
you folks at Extension
would know something. To be here.
Okay. One other plant. Gwen picked this up. My wife's always picking up stuff. But she picked up something called beauty berries. Do you know anything about those?
I do. So beauty berry is a native shrub. It's not necessarily fruit, you know, a fruit tree or fruit bush, but it does have this small, it's a very beautiful purple berry that blooms in the fall time. You can make a jelly. And so when you look at old like recipes and kind of homestead, you know, kind of country folk, there's been some beauty berry jelly. Also, the other thing that's redeemable is the leaves have a compound that create like a natural bug repellent.
Oh,
so
really?
Yeah, if you look up different like weed websites, foragers, and you know, herbalism, beautyberry has some really great compounds that can be used medicinally and for like bugs and stuff.
Okay. Well, this has been a really, really good introduction to various fruit. I'll have you on again and we can talk about more in depth about berries and nut trees. I'm just learning about nuts here. Actually, we had a chance to get a Chinese chestnut and I passed on it. And the person who did Brandy Hall, who did our permaculture design here, had actually recommended some plantings of Chinese chestnuts here. So I really would love to have you back to talk about the various nuts that are out there. You know, everybody thinks of pecans here in Georgia, but if I plant pecans today, you know, my grandkids or my great grandkids are going to reap the benefits of those trees. You know,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to thank you, Robbie, for taking the time, and hope everybody will take some stuff from this and go plant some fruit.
Right on. Great to be with you and good luck, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.